8:30 a.m. KSDP Radio. I'm Kels Hetherington, and this is Meet the People for Tuesday, November the 23rd, 2010. My guest this morning is State Representative Bryce Edgman. He represents this area in the Alaska State House in Juneau. Well, welcome to the program, Representative Edgman. Well, we have you there, Representative. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Well, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to be here.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
Now, if people want to call in and ask Representative Edgman a question on the air, you can do that. The call-in number is 383-2162. Again, that number is 2162. When you call in, I will put you live on the air immediately, so just hold on a second until I recognize your question and call. Well, last time we spoke, it was before the elections, and now, well, it is sort of after the elections. The Alaska U.S. Senate race remains up in the air. Many people may not know this, but Senator Murkowski has not been officially certified as the winner by the state of Alaska. Joe Miller is in court trying to contest thousands of write-in ballots cast for, according to the Division of Elections, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Now, the Miller people filed a lawsuit in state court on Monday after securing a temporary injunction on Friday from a federal judge. Okay, so you're in politics. You know some of the people who are involved, Bryce. Who do you suspect wins the U.S. Senate race in Alaska?
Well, you never know because certainly at this point it's up to the courts. But I think the conventional thinking is that there is enough sort of legal history out there with the Supreme Court in Alaska basically having addressed this issue a number of times before. They did it once in the 70s, they did it once, I think, in the 90s, and most recently in 2007. And the whole subject, of course, is just what comprises or what makes up voter intent. And what Joe Miller is arguing is that that a number of the write-in ballots were too liberally construed over to that the Division of Elections sort of came in and made up their own rules and applying a number of these names and signatures that either spelled out Lisa Murkowski in some instances correctly, but there might have been a comma between the two names or that there might have been some phonetic differences. But anyway, Miller is contending through state court now that the votes were illegally counted, and he wants to have a recount and have each vote, including his ballots, recounted by hand.
Now, the Miller people are also alleging possible fraud in places like Cordova. They've said that in a press release. They've also said the voting system used in Alaska is plagued with a long history of problems, which the Democrats have identified and sued over in past years. And they want a hand recount of the Joe Miller votes that were cast by machines. Is that something that might yield Mr. Miller more votes in the U.S. Senate race, or is that something that you would advise against? Do you think there's no more votes for Mr. Miller?
Well, you know, potentially it could. It could sort of unearth, if you will, a few written votes, for example, that would go Joe Miller's way that the division failed to count. And this would probably be on those ballots that didn't qualify as write-in ballots. But, you know, my history with the Division of Elections, and certainly with the director, Gail Fenumani, I've known her for many years. She started, one of the lower-level jobs in the division, and a couple years ago was appointed as a director. So I have a high degree of confidence in her integrity, her understanding of the elections process. And I'll tell you this, for those local precinct officials who put in long hours, who volunteer their time, who are there from in the morning till night on election day, well into night in some examples, they do their job to the best of their abilities well. So for somebody like Joe Miller to come in and sort of allege that there was fraud or wrongdoing or misapplication of law, you know, for me, I'm personally very confident that that's not going to be the case when the court gets done reviewing all the facts. And the only degree of uncertainty, I guess, that's really out there is that we've never had a write-in race, certainly of this magnitude, probably anywhere in the country. This is going back 54 years. I think Strom Thurmond actually won a statewide write-in candidate against a somebody who's on the ballot who's actually deceased. So 54 years worth of time going by, we haven't had a statewide write-in race that the write-in candidate actually prevailed, which is what appears to be happening with Lisa Murkowski. So for the courts to go in, you know, you could argue that the courts may apply a higher degree of scrutiny than they've ever done before, given the magnitude of this race and the fact that it's a U.S. Senate race that's at stake. But in my mind, again, having experience, I'm not an attorney, but having experience with the election process and certainly the personnel at the Division of Election, I'm pretty confident that Senator Murkowski will ultimately be sworn in and hopefully will be there when Congress convenes for the new session on January 3rd.
Now, just one more question about the undecided U.S. Senate race in Alaska. And again, if people want to call in, they can do so. You can ask your questions right on the air to Representative Bryce Edgman, who represents you in Juneau, if you're listening over the air. If you're listening online, well, I guess he may or may not represent you. You could be listening in someplace like Connecticut, of all places. But the question I have about the Senate race remaining is, if Joe Miller loses this, after all these lawsuits, is he finished politically?
Well, that is a great question, and the voters would be the only ones that could ultimately decide that. But, you know, you would have to think, based on the public reaction, I think there is, Randy Riedrich, the chairman of the Republican Party, for example, urging Miller to basically concede and to recognize the reality that Senator Murkowski has won the race. I think what Miller risks going forward is burning what political capital he's been able to muster in the last few months, basically going from an unknown candidate, somebody from Fairbanks who had run for the state house a couple years ago and got beaten, had gone from that position to being a statewide force in politics in Alaska. And that if he wishes to, you know, run for office down the road, that maybe at some point here in the process, and it'll be for him to decide when, he needs to consider whether he's burning more bridges by dragging things out, if you will, or if he's actually, believing he's got a legal chance to overturn the outcome of the race.
All right, we're talking with Bryce Edgman. He represents this district in the State House. You can call in at 383-2162. Denby Lloyd, a commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, announced back in September that he would be stepping down from his position. He spent 28 years with the department that he now leads. Any idea about why he may have decided to relinquish his position?
Well, you know, I've known Denby for 25-odd years. I knew him when he worked for the Lucians East Borough. I knew him when he worked with Governor Cooper's office. I've known him in two different stints as the Division of Commercial Fisheries Director. So I've known him more in a professional capacity than I have in a personal capacity. But I've not directly asked him what his plans were, but my sense, just sort of indirectly and talking to some of the staff, was that that he had put in 4 years in a very demanding job, and you know he's been a long-term employee of the state, and certainly was probably looking to do other things in life. And I'm guessing that's why he decided to sort of stand down and allow someone else to take probably what is the most contentious commissioner job in all of the state of Alaska, and that's to be the commissioner of not only the fish side, but also the game side. So I certainly wish Denby well and, you know, look forward to working with him wherever he sort of reemerges at.
I know that Commissioner Lloyd is a former employee of the borough, so he is well acquainted with goings-on in this neck of the woods. Who is going to be his replacement, and how will they affect Sandpoint, King Cove, and Cold Bay?
Well, that's a good question in the sense that it's not as easy as the governor sort of appointing his or her name and then having that go forward to the legislature for confirmation like most of the commissioners do. With the Department of Fish and Game, because of the constitutional requirements, the names actually have to go before the Joint Board of Fish and Game, and then from there go to the governor, who ultimately selects the person he wants, and then and of course, again, subject to legislative confirmation. As has been publicly released here the last 2 weeks or so, the governor has appointed Cora Campbell, who's been his fishery advisor for the last 4 years, originally appointed by Governor Palin, but for Cora Campbell to be the sort of interim fish and game commissioner with the understanding that she would put her name in to be the permanent commissioner. So she, along with any other names, are going to have to, you know, once again, go before the joint boards of fish and game, go through the application and review process, and then if she survives that, for example, then her name would ultimately go to legislature for confirmation, a process that takes place at the end of session, which would be in April of next year.
Now, Cora Campbell is going to be the governor's, recommendation. How likely is it that that would be approved by the legislature?
Oh, boy, that's, you know, very broadly speaking, I would guess that she would have good support throughout the legislature. She's, as they say, a known commodity. She's been on the governor's floor for 4 years now, has been visible throughout throughout the various fisheries arenas throughout the state, certainly in the Capitol building, knows a lot of legislators personally. She originates from Petersburg, so she's got a strong history in Southeast Alaska, but because of her duties the past 4 years, she does have a lot of statewide experience in the fisheries front. I've seen her at a lot of Board of Fish meetings. I've seen her at the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute meetings, North Pacific Fishery Council meetings. She's, you know, been the representative for the state the past two meetings. And so, my personal sense is that she would have a lot of support. But in the world of fisheries and certainly in the world of politics, you never know until the vote is taken, that's for sure.
Yeah, who knows? But Parnell has a pretty good relationship with the legislature, doesn't he?
I think he does overall. He's a former legislator himself, so he knows the bumps and grinds of the process, and he knows how to craft a message and to personally relate to legislators. And so, yeah, I would say overall he's got a pretty good relationship with the legislature.
All right, you can call into the program. The number to do so is 383-2162. Changing gears here and talking about the ferry. The ferry is an issue of continuing concern to people in the Aleutians throughout your district. Or most of it, I should say. You managed to get help funding, or to help get funding back in place to have twice a month service to the Aleutian Islands last year. Now, the governor's budget is not out just yet, but it will be in about 3 weeks. Do you expect that the funding to continue the twice a month ferry run to the Aleutians will remain, or are we going to see some adjustment there?
Well, first, let me state that myself and Senator Hoffman, and certainly the borough officials and many others throughout the various communities, worked hard to get an interim fix. And we did get 1 year's worth of funding into the capital budget for the twice-a-month ferry service. That funding ends next May, so it would be May of 2011. And so we've been championing since then to get the money sort of on a more permanent basis into the budget. Now, we haven't seen the governor's budget yet, either the operating or the capital budgets, and so we don't know for sure. And if it isn't in the budget, I would assure local folks that we're going to make it a big deal in terms of trying to get back into the budget like we did last year. And interestingly enough, the morning headlines, yesterday's headlines actually, is that the ferry chief, actually one of the deputy commissioners in the Department of Transportation, the guy who actually oversaw the Alaska Marine Highway System, is now retiring. So there will be a new head official for the Marine Highway System in Alaska, and how that works in our favor, we will certainly wait to see. But let me just conclude by saying that this is a huge issue for the Aleutian region, Alaska Peninsula. And we're going to do everything we can in Juneau to make sure that it gets top billing.
So if the money is not in the governor's budget when it comes out in 3 weeks, you will go back and try to get into the capital budget? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we will definitely attempt to do that, just as we've done before. A couple times we've been unsuccessful last year. you know, we were successful, and I think the governor did play a role in understanding the importance of the twice-a-month ferry service out to the region and supported it. And, you know, we'll see if, again, if he's got in his upcoming budget that's due out here in the middle of December.
You know, one thought that I was having this morning is pen air prices are going up again this year. Would there be any chance of getting some subsidy from the state to subsidize transportation on the airline for people who live in the Aleutian Islands?
Well, you know, and let's just say that we're able to make that happen. It certainly wouldn't just be for one part of the state. I think it would be for all the outlying parts of the state because aviation costs, transportation costs are going up across the state. I guess the short answer is, well, we'd sure like to see it there, but it would probably not be realistic given that there just isn't any sort of political support for it. And also understanding that the marine highway system is subsidized to some degree, and power cost equalization for those that use it in the region certainly is considered to be a state subsidy. And I think it'd be pretty difficult to muster up the support to get, you know, some kind of a statewide subsidy for local airlines. And also, you know, the bypass mail is a federal subsidy, if you will. And so there's already some sort of programs in place, but to get something for individual travelers, I just don't see it happening down in Juneau.
Now, not enough subsidy, obviously, because prices are still going up. And my point, I guess, is that if the state government is going to be subsidizing transportation to the Aleutian Islands, why not do it 12 months out of the year instead of just a few in the summer months with the ferry? I know the ferry is a state operation, the Alaska Marine Highway, but maybe it would be cheaper to just subsidize the airplane. We'd still need it for cars, and that brings me to my next question. There are some people in Dutch Harbor you were talking about to me yesterday who are unhappy with the ferry service because they complain that the ferry is leaving Homer full of cars destined for Kodiak, leaving no room for vehicles bound for the Aleutians. So is there any way that your office might be able to possibly address this issue and have like a quota system so that so many of the places on the ferry would be left for cars bound for Sandpoint, Dutch Harbor, King Cove, and Cold Bay?
Boy, for all those, this has been a frustrating issue for in the region. It certainly has been a frustrating issue for our office as well, because we had this very distinct conversation with the department last session when it became apparent that we're going to be able to get the money into the budget for the twice a month for the upcoming year, that if we, you know, if we got the funding there, we needed to have the access for the communities further along on the Southwest Ferry route down by you know, Dutch Harbor, certainly up into the Alaska Peninsula, King Cove and Sandpoint and so on, that that these communities needed to have access at Homer because they were getting sort of pushed aside by all the traffic that was bound for Kodiak. And then once the ferry leaves Kodiak, it's basically, in some respects, a half or even three-quarters empty, making its rounds all the way up the chain past the Chignecks and then back to Homer. And so, you know, we're not only going to try to get the funding next year for the program on a more permanent basis, but we're also going to continue working with the department to make some kind of allotment for local traffic because, again, if you can't get your vehicles on in Homer or you can't get any of your freight on, what the heck's the use of having the ferry come all the way around? I mean, you could certainly argue that point, and we're going to continue you know, making it known that that's what local ferry travelers want. They want to be able to get their vehicles on in Homer and use it just as people in Kodiak can do.
All right. Changing gears once again, Bryce, the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, chaired by Erskine Bowles, who I think was the chief of staff for President Clinton for a while anyway, is recommending to President Barack Obama that several rural utility programs that issue grants and loans, and among them the Denali Commission, be cut from the federal budget. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with these utility programs, the Denali Commission provides financial support for rural infrastructure projects, and it has done so for programs and projects here in Sandpoint. Is there any way that you can conceive of or you've heard of that this program may be able to stay in place?
Well, the Denali Commission has, from a funding perspective, really seen its better days, and I don't mean that and be as fatalistic as that might sound. And let me backtrack for just a second to say that when the Denali Commission first started, it was a creature of Senator Stevens drawing upon the experiences of Senator Byrd and the Appalachians Commission and so forth. But at one point, the Denali Commission was getting upwards of $100 and $150 million of federal dollars to go out and do everything from health clinics to transportation projects to energy infrastructure items and so on and so forth. But now we're seeing the Denali Commission funding basically be at a bare bones level at $12, $13, $14 million a year. And so that the commission itself is really having to backtrack and struggle and redefine what its roles are, what its capabilities are, and this, that, and the other. But on the positive side, the legislature last time, for the first time ever, approve money for the commission. I think it was $3 million. And this allowed Joel Niemeyer and others representing on behalf of the commissioner to go back to Washington, D.C. and say, hey, look, the state's got some skin in the game. They've ponied up some money. We'd like for the federal government to better recognize all the good things that the commission is doing and tell our story. And interestingly enough, it was, I heard that, because of Senator Stevens' ability to just sort of, unilaterally fund the budget of the commission, that here's the Denali Commission in 2009, 2010, having to go back to Washington, D.C., and all of a sudden go door-to-door, office-to-office, trying to get political support where it hadn't had to before. And so I think they're in a process now of sort of trying to map out a different strategy back east, of trying to tell their story a little more thoroughly. And in terms of the deficit commission that you mentioned, that's just a report. It has to go through the political process, and I think that we have some strong champions with the Representative Young, Senator Begich, and hopefully Senator Murkowski that will help, get the Denali Commission back on the track in terms of its federal funding amounts.
All right. Talking here with Representative Bryce Edgman. He represents this district in the Alaska State House. He just won re-election, by the way, too. The measure calling for the expansion of the state legislature by 10% failed on Election Day. Only about 40% of voters in the state supported the idea. This means that the redistricting process will now move forward to create a state house and house districts that have equivalent populations, but there'll only be 40 house seats. How is this going to affect you and other rural legislators?
Boy, that is a great question. I guess the best way to respond to that would be to say that when you look at the state population as a whole in Alaska, it's increased. But once you move outside of the urban south-central area of Alaska, the population levels in all of the outlying districts in southeast, southwest, western, northwest, interior villages, all of those house districts have declined in population. And meanwhile, with the redrawing of the legislative boundaries occurring every 10 years, we're approaching that cycle, with the legislative districts being redrawn next year. So you've sort of got a double whammy here of the rural districts going down in numbers and the urban house districts going up, so that the average across the state in 2000, the average district house district was 15,000 and change. Now we're looking at 17,000 and change, or possibly even 18,000 a district. So as you mentioned, we're going to have to apportion out 40 house seats with that type of a redistribution of voters throughout the state. And how is it going to impact Southwest Alaska, or how is it going to impact Southeast, or any of these other rural districts? It's certainly not going to be in a positive way, because we're going to look at probably the loss of two, or maybe the worst case scenario, three house districts, and certainly the stretching of existing house districts. And how all that plays out, we'll know next spring when the official census numbers are provided to the redistricting board, and when they come out with their proposals or their redrawing of the legislative map in Alaska. And all this is expected to be probably next spring sometime. So, you know, I think it's going to be something that everybody's going to closely watch. And you know, the past couple of years, it's been probably the biggest priority of the Bush caucus to be monitoring this issue and to be closely tracking who got on the redistricting committee, who the executive director was, and, you know, all the details involved with that process.
Now, this issue may also attract the attention of federal authorities in the federal Justice Department, because both state and federal law says that people who are Native Alaskans or Native Americans and people who live in rural areas of the nation have a unique right to have access to their state representative. So it's conceivable that the federal courts might hold up a redistricting plan. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, you know, and I wouldn't say it's any more unique than anyone else throughout the country. And this, of course, goes back to the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which said that, you know, every man gets the right to have an equal vote, one man, one vote concept. In Alaska, very interestingly, because of our large dispersions of minority populations, you know, in some areas exclusively Alaska Natives, we're one of nine states that has to have their redistricting plan actually pre-cleared or has to be approved by the U.S. Justice Department. And, you know, the other eight states are from the South, where there's been, you know, their own issues of having sort of minority discriminations and the issues of redrawing legislative districts so that minority populations aren't favored or they don't have equal access to the representation, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we you know, expect to see a proposed redrawing of Alaska legislative boundaries next spring sometime. And I guess expect to see a challenge in court because somebody along the line is going to claim that their interests aren't being met, whether it's, you know, the Tanana Chiefs Conference, for example, up in the interior, or whether it's somebody else down in southeast or maybe southwest or what have you. Somebody is going to claim that they weren't fairly represented in the way the lines were redrawn. And so I think it's almost just sort of a matter of practice that we will see a court challenge to the upcoming redrawing of the legislative lines here in Alaska.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you for actually saying what I was trying to get at, the 1965 Voter Rights Act. That's exactly what I was looking for. And I wanted to add also that some of the state house districts in Alaska are among the are the largest in the United States. And so it is a big job to represent these state house districts. You have to go get all over the state almost in some cases, or what would be a state in some other part of the country. Well, the legislature, I guess, gavels back into session January the 18th. What do you suppose will be the first agenda item?
Well, we have Governor Parnell, who was elected now in his own right for a four-year term, and with him come changes in the administration that that Governor Parnell had inherited from then Governor Palin. So, we will have a number of new commissioners. We will have a number of new deputy commissioners, division directors, new staff in the executive branch. As well as on the legislative side of things, we have a number of new legislators, I think seven new legislators in the House, and on the Senate side there's one new legislator, but you've got some different faces and different leadership positions, and so all that is going to come together to help determine what the priorities are, but generally speaking, certainly the budget is always the overriding issue for each session, but we're also looking this next session at probably some attempt to review the oil tax structure, which is a very onerous and complicated issue and something that could easily spill over into a special session. I've, in fact, heard that a number of times already. And also, I think the legislature will be focused on getting a gas line whether it be the smaller bullet line from the North Slope down to Tidewater at Valdez, or whether it be the bigger one all the way down to Alberta. Expect the legislature to focus a lot of its attention on that, and certainly, you know, many other issues that will be the priority of individual legislators like myself. But we could talk at length about that. But that, I think, is Kel's a sort of a broad sketch of some of the very large priorities that the legislature expects to face.
All right. Well, Representative Edgman, thank you so much for calling in today and talking with us on the radio. I know a lot of people are listening. It's pretty bad weather out here, so actually a lot of people are trapped in Anchorage right now, but are waiting to be flown out to Anchorage for Thanksgiving. So I know a lot of people are listening, and so but good to talk to you today, and hopefully we can follow up with you when the legislature is back in session.
Well, absolutely, and just very quickly, I would say that my office, I am having Adam Berg and Tim Clark return, and we will be doing an electronic newsletter that we send out every Friday. If people want to get on that list, please call my office at 1-800-898-4451. It's a toll-free number. We can add your name to that list, and as always, we encourage people to call in to communicate with our office, and if there's anything we can do to help you individually or collectively as a community, you know, that's why we're down in Juneau. And with that, I'll sign off and say thank you very much for the opportunity, Kels, and I look forward to the next interview that we do.
Oh, so do I. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bryce Edgman. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. That's Representative Bryce Edgman on a Tuesday morning, week of Thanksgiving. Yeah, the legislature goes back into session January the 18th. We'll now go to NPR News from Washington, D.C. We're going to join that newscast a bit late because it started a minute ago, but here it goes.